Welcome. This is the last show I get to host this year, so that makes it pretty special for me. I'm Rhonda McBride, always happy to keep you company with some good conversation, and we have some of that coming up on Juno Afternoon. 2021 in the rearview mirror, year two of the pandemic. Did we move backwards or forwards? KTOO's managing editor and daily news editor will join us for their take on a year that was once again dominated by the coronavirus, which had its low points, but also its high points. We will also look at some of the other big stories of the year, the troubling number of people reported missing, the return of big cruise ships and its impact on the Juno economy, as well as an avalanche threat that forced one Juno neighborhood to evacuate. Jennifer Pemberton and Rasha McChesney will also share some of their favorite stories of 2021. So join us on Juno Afternoon for 2021 in the rearview mirror. In our forecast for tonight, look for clouds to increase with a chance of snow later on. Northeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, putting an edge to lows that will range from 12 to 22 degrees. Now tomorrow morning, we have a chance of snow, highs from 19 to 25 degrees, northeast winds 10 to 15 miles an hour, persisting through tomorrow. And then tomorrow night, it turns clear and colder, lows dropping down to 3 to 13 degrees, and around Eagle Crest, expect even colder temperatures, down to 5 below. And from here through Monday, you can expect colder nighttime temperatures. Christmas Eve, mostly clear skies, highs from 8 to 14 degrees, clear skies, Friday night lows from 2 to 6 degrees above. Christmas Day, nice day to get out and play. Clear skies through Sunday, but bundle up. Highs on Saturday from 5 to 11 degrees. Sunday, daytime highs a little warmer, 7 to 13 degrees. And by Saturday night, we could see lows from minus 4 to 4 above. And Sunday night, look for lows from 2 to 8 degrees, a little bit warmer. Monday and Tuesday, partly cloudy skies, daytime highs in the low to mid-teens. Yesterday, we celebrated solstice, the shortest day of the year, and today we turn the corner. Sunrise tomorrow morning at 8:45, sunset at 3:08. So for tomorrow, we have a total of 6 hours, 23 minutes of daylight, about 16 seconds more than the day before. But we have turned the corner on darkness and headed into what Juno poet Richard Stokes calls the season of hope.
My name is Richard Stokes. I enjoy writing about the winter solstice because I think it presents hope. Here's a poem. Seasonal promise. November slid into darkness, each day darker than the one before. Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday passed as the sun rose later in the morning and went to sleep earlier in the afternoon. On days when rain and snow clouds hovered just above the spruce tops, you wondered if the sun rose at all. But here we are at December's bottom, but at the door leading to summer. We know the world will tilt to open its window more to the sun. We are promised longer lit days and brighter spirits into summer.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Tlinédi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on what were once tide lands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from their homes from these tide lands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and the future.
Hands and grass, ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakaya ha anikak, gunil cheesh.
Sheesh for being here with us today. You are listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. You know, it's rare that I actually get to have conversations with KTOO news managers because they're always on deadline, always speeding down the road to the next story, and they don't get much time to reflect, so they just have to keep moving from one story to the next, and such is the news business. But yesterday, I managed to reel in Jennifer Pemberton, the managing editor for KTOO News, and Rasha McChesney, the daily news editor and a reporter as well. And my hope was that we would look back in the rearview mirror at the top stories of the year. But Rasha and Jennifer did more than that. They also shared insights into how they approached news coverage last year. How do we evaluate 2021? Much was going on. How are we gonna organize this for the listeners so they can follow us?
Yeah, I'm always kind of curious when news outlets say, you know, what the top stories were of the year, like by what metric. And for me, like I can't. It was more than three stories, and top can mean good and bad, right? So I sort of measure stories by impact. I think about the stories that were the most sort of important for the audience. So that's, you know, sort of informationally, but also, you know, stories that hit people emotionally, the stories that made people live their lives differently. I mean, that's sort of what we're going for. That's sort of my goal. So I kind of found three buckets of stories of sort of that I felt like were the most important from the year. It was really hard to even narrow that down, but unfortunately, COVID still dominated our year. I was hoping that wasn't going to be the biggest story of the year, but it sort of was. And it's really interesting to think back on the year in COVID, because here we are right now where it just feels like maybe nothing has changed. But if you think back to January, the city was hosting these mass vaccination events, and Rasha went to the first one. There were thousands, like as in more than 1,000 at least, people who were lined up at Centennial Hall that had these 15-minute appointment slots to go get vaccinated. And we were just vaccinating the whole community in like rapid fire.
I don't think people will ever forget that, because it was very strange. What do you think, Rasha?
I think the thing that really stuck out to me, both going there as a journalist and just as a person who's alive during a pandemic, was this hope. Like, for the first time in months since, February of 2020, there was this sort of overriding community feeling of, oh, thank God, we've held on long enough, and now this light is at the end of the tunnel. And I think, unfortunately, 2021 for me, when we think about that bucket of COVID stories, is the story of thinking that we were coming out of the pandemic and then learning that we weren't, and how communities have responded to that. Because the people that I ran into at that vaccine clinic were the first people who qualified in Juneau. They were the immunocompromised people. They were frontline responders. They were our elderly. And I think I think there was just that hope. I remember very specifically how excited people were, how many people cried when they got vaccinated for the first time, and how many people
dressed up.
People did. They dressed up. There were some costumes. Some people wore fancy dresses. Some people, I mean, it was just this, it was a party.
And there were musicians in some cases performing. Zool Bailey on his cello.
Somebody played the grand piano at one point. You know, there was just this, we as a community felt like we were coming out of it. And then I think we didn't.
Right.
Well, for a lot of people, especially older people that were getting vaccinated, they weren't able to see their grandchildren. And so they were now getting hope that they would, with their vaccinations, be able to spend more time with family.
Yeah, and things in the spring, you know, felt good. Like, and the kids' vaccines came out. First 12 and under, and then 5 and under. And kids went back to school, which was huge because we learned that having kids out of school for a year was really, really bad for them. There was hope, and people were planning summer vacations to see their families, to see their grandparent reunions, the hot vac summer, and then Delta came, right? And this was June, July, and then by August and September, September was the deadliest month for in Juneau and in Alaska and in a lot of places for COVID. And so, you know, the trajectory of things, it felt right? Like we had spring. Spring is just this so hopeful time. And then this sort
we
of...
We had 1 month of hot bag summer, Jennifer. We have
did.
One. I went to one in-person drag show where everyone, we did a story about that, where everyone had to show up and show their vax card at the door. And once you got in, no one was masked. And it was hot and sweaty. There were hugs. There were drag performers. It was like a hedonist's dream after a year of sleeping in a cave. And we had 1 month of hot vac summer. And then Delta just...
And then it got bad.
One thing I will say, though, is I appreciate how people adjusted. Because as we got into the fall, we had some live entertainment in Juneau performances. And, of course, you had to show proof of vaccination to get in. But they made adaptations with seating. And it maybe it was an incentive to get vaccinated because that was your pass into real events. I don't want to say that virtual events aren't real, but they don't have quite the same impact as being part of a live audience.
No, but I think that's part of the story of Hope in Juneau, too, that really stuck with me this year was how many organizations that are used to relying on in-person events found these really creative and unique outlets for entertainment because we all need it. So KTOO teamed up with Juneau Ghost Light Theater and we did a radio production of Dracula because we couldn't all be crammed into a room together watching it in person. We had digital drag for 18 months. We had so many concerts. Folk Fest was stunning when we did an all remote concert. And I just sort of love that the community found all of these ways to connect with each other, even though we were, you know, apart.
I think that is going to change the way people do conferences, people do events, is that there probably will have to be some virtual hybrid component going forward.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the transition we're in now, right? Because we do have the vaccine, but that hasn't totally changed things, right? It feels like going backwards, but we have made progress. We do have vaccines. Death rates are going down. We've learned to live with the pandemic, which like maybe doesn't feel like progress, but it is, right? That we've adapted and that we've changed and that we've learned that we can change as a society, which I think is really important. But it's hard. It's hard to think about right now like what the future holds for us because it's a little bit of both. And it's hard to find that spark of hope, right? Because now we're vaxxed and we're boosted and we're getting at-home tests, I guess, is the latest thing.
Yeah, the city and the state and the school district have made it possible to pick up free at-home tests. And a thing that I think is really interesting about that is that we, in the same year, went from people trying their hardest to get signed up for a vaccine appointment to people being able to have their kids in school even if they get exposed to a classmate, because you can test them at home and you can test your whole family. So we definitely have made sort of technological progress in living alongside this pandemic. There's hope. It's just, you know, I think my hope is for more sweaty dancing with my friends. And that seems like it's not in the cards quite yet.
You know, one thing I wonder about is 10 years from now, 5 years from now, what we are going to know about the course of pandemics. And you certainly look back at the one in 1918 and 1919 that swept through Alaska and took out a big chunk of Bristol Bay. I mean, hundreds of people died in that. And when you read the historical descriptions of that, now they were kind of a year out from the main brunt of the pandemic. And it seems like whatever hit them, if you read the accounts, was pretty lethal. I mean, people were dead within days or hours of contact with people that had the virus. So, you know, you do know that, gosh, it does have cycles where it comes back around, and maybe that's one thing we've learned about this. With this latest round, you wonder, well, okay, is it going to be worse? Is it going to be, how will we get through this Omicron? Is it pronounced Omicron?
I've heard Omicron. I've heard Omicron.
I say both in the same report sometimes.
Omicron. One thing that has really struck me this year, and specifically thinking about how the state's handled pandemics in the past, is looking at our tribal health organizations and how quickly they responded. I mean, communities in Southeast Alaska got vaccinated so fast by search, by getting that sort of tribal vaccine allocation, and how rapidly that was deployed. I think it was sort of seeing the lessons of a previous pandemic in action. And I'm really curious how the state and even the federal government is going to take these lessons that we've learned during this pandemic and apply them in the future, because we are still struggling with how public health should respond during a pandemic. But definitely there's a sort of story of two Alaskas that we're still telling. And in one of those stories, I mean, I just think there's two Alaskas. I guess that's what I'll say about that.
Yeah. But one thing about the tribal health impact is that they brought a lot of resources to the state that we wouldn't ordinarily have had. And I know in some communities, they provided testing for the public at large. I mean, they were the main service. And vaccines. And because tribal populations were vaccinated, that made everything safer for everybody. It kind of raised our level. At one point, we were doing really well in that season of hope you talk about in the spring. But I think we owe a lot to the tribal organizations in our response to the pandemic.
We really do. And it's really helpful to look back on the year, because covering the pandemic has just been so weird as a news organization. I mean, we put out daily reports on case counts and vaccine numbers, and you know, you sort of, it's like the audio version of a graph, but it's so, you can't see what's happening until you sort of zoom out. It's important to sort of be on top of it and to share that information. But we have hardly had time to stop and think about this arc, the arc of the year, because we're just sort of in it. And that's not just journalists. I mean, I think everybody feels that way. We're living day to day, and it's really hard to kind of zoom out. And you do get some perspective by thinking about, I think, Rhonda, what you were saying, too, of just like, you know, even the waves of the pandemic, or how it hits different parts of the world, or even to think historically, like, that pandemic had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this one will too, right? We just don't really, we're just in the middle of it. And we
I think
don't
we're
know.
In that part on the roller coaster where you like get high and then you drop down and then you get high and then you drop down and you're just sort of like,
you don't know
this
how many
is
more.
Fun and I kind of want to throw up, but when's the end?
So, Rasha, you did a lot of stories in the last year. And I'm just curious, which ones stand out to you on COVID, besides the vaccinations, the mass vaccinations?
I mean, I think for a lot of journalists and myself, you know, we kind of went into 2020 and now into 2021 with like a different idea of what our job was as reporters. I mean, I was an environmental policy reporter and doing energy reporting, and then we pivoted, and I think all of us are COVID reporters now. And for me, the ones that stick out the most aren't really about the numbers or the sort of relentless march of deaths and tracking them and tracking sort of state policy to the pandemic. For me, the stories that stick out have been the ones about people finding hope and the community banding together and how the city found ways to get vaccines into arms as quickly as possible. I did some reporting on the first week of our pediatric vaccine clinics at the schools a few months ago. And there's this great photo that I keep thinking of a father who went and got two of his kids vaccinated, and he, you know, grabbed his daughter afterward and kissed her. And it's just this moment of like, there is hope. People are finding hope in these spaces. Those are the things that stick out to me. It's like people finding ways to protect each other, keep each other safe. And, you know, then there's just like the sort of fun things that we did. I really enjoyed the, hey, I think Hot Vax Summer is here. Let's go report on a drag show. We did a whole documentary in a month about having a drag show in a pandemic.
Yeah, and it was more than just about a drag show. It was a story about community.
Yeah, that's I have been consistently reminded this year of how my community protects me and how I can protect my community. And I think that's really valuable because for a lot of people that doesn't exist. And I think it would be really exhausting to move through this pandemic in a city where I felt alone.
Coming up, some of the other top stories of the year, which also required fresh approaches to news coverage. When we come back, more of my conversation with Rasha McChesney and Jennifer Pemberton.
Juneau Public Health Center is offering free walk-in COVID-19 vaccines every weekday from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. First doses are available for everyone ages 5 and up, and booster doses are available to age 18 and up. The Public Health Center is located on Glacier Highway across the street from the Twin Lakes parking lot. Again, walk in any weekday from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Juneau Public Health Center to get your COVID-19 vaccine. This message sponsored by the City and Borough of Juneau.
This is Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride, and thank you for being here with us today as we look at 2021 in the rearview mirror. I've been talking with Jennifer Pemberton and Rasha McChesney, news managers here at KTOO, and in the first part of our program, we looked at the biggest bucket of stories, KTOO's coronavirus coverage, a constant moving target. But within that pale of the pandemic, there are some other buckets of news that Rasha McChesney and Jennifer Pemberton wanted us to take a look at.
You said that the other bucket of stories was the missing people that we've had, the high number. And I wondered if some of that could be attributed to COVID indirectly, people being isolated. Maybe not. Maybe it was just something that happened this year.
I don't know that we know, but yeah, looking back on the year, a sort of strange theme emerged, and it was something we kind of noticed about midway through the year, and people were sort of asking, the community was asking, boy, it seems like there's more missing people in Juneau than normal. We still don't know statistically how to answer that question, if there were more, but one thing that really changed, and it changed in our newsroom, was sort of how we reported on those cases, because we used to sort of wait for the Juneau Police Department to put out a press release, and the press release said somebody's missing, and if they didn't have any leads, if they didn't suspect foul play, there wasn't any follow-up. And what we started noticing was that on Facebook, families of missing people were organizing these search parties. And it dawned on me, I didn't realize that the responsibility of that fell on citizens and on family members of people who had gone missing. And I think it kind of started with Geraldine Nelson, who was an elder who went missing in Lemon Creek. And Rasha, we learned a lot about the silver alert system.
We did. I think when you ask that question of who's responsible for finding a missing family member, and I talked to a lot of family members of missing people this year who told me that until someone they loved went missing, they kind of assumed that you report that person missing and the police and the Sea Dogs and the Coast Guard and the troopers go looking for that person. But that's not actually what happens. If they have a good lead about where that person might be, maybe all of those resources will come to bear. But at some point, we live in a wilderness. We live in a difficult place to search, and no one agency is taking responsibility for finding missing people, and it does fall on family members. And when Geraldine Nelson went missing, you know, Tlingit Haida stepped up and was organizing searches for her. Her family members were organizing searches for her. And in her case, she was known to walk around town pretty regularly. She would be gone for several hours at a time, but this was different. And Lindsay Berlini, one of our newer reporters, sort of chased that story down to its obvious sort of bare-bone question of, does our silver alert system work? And it turns out that it doesn't actually work the way that maybe it's supposed to, or maybe people expect that it will. And so people who knew that she was missing didn't know where to go search. They didn't know, they'd never got an alert that a vulnerable adult was missing, which is what a silver alert is. And so we ended up kind of reporting on the mechanics of the search process, and that led us down this rabbit hole of, well, maybe we should be talking about who's organizing these, how do they organize them, what's our responsibility as a news organization in contributing to public safety in that way.
Yeah, so by the time the sort of next person went missing, which was, I think, Joe Clayton was the next one, which there was a silver alert out, I think, because he was a vulnerable adult.
There was a silver alert out, but it never actually got pushed out to anybody. So you could find it on their website, but you couldn't. There are still questions right. about if that system works the way that it's
right.
supposed
so
to.
So we were sort of clued in to sort of start looking at these stories differently and to kind of do our own. I'm not saying we were the investigators on any of these, but we did try to put together the information that was out there into one place, which none of the agencies were really doing, but the families were doing.
So do you anticipate any follow-up to kind of break down some of the reasons behind why people might have been missing?
I think in all of these cases, the circumstances have been so different that it's really difficult to say, oh, you know, these are even sort of indirectly related to COVID. I think the search response is definitely impacted by COVID. How many people are going to gather in one place to go searching for a person? How are public safety resources, how are we spending our time during the pandemic? But I don't think that it's possible at this point to look at all of the people who have gone missing this year and say, well, sort of conclusively, these are linked to this. And we're not really reporting on that. What we're reporting on is the public safety response and who is ultimately responsible for finding people when they go missing. And deeper, sort of, how do we classify a vulnerable adult? Who gets searched for and who doesn't? Those are the questions that we're asking and that we're continually reporting on.
I guess we call it accountability reporting in this business, where you're really trying to figure out who's responsible for these things. And that work is going to continue because we don't really have answers. I'm not even going to say, like, what's broken about the system. Like, we're not even to a place where we can point any fingers. And I don't want anybody to think that we are pointing fingers at deficiencies. We're just saying, like, that this is not coordinated and it's really, really hard on families.
And we need to know more.
And we need to know more across the board.
So I look forward to learning more about that. In case you just joined us, I'm talking with Jennifer Pemberton. She's the managing editor for KTOO News, and Rasha McChesney, the daily news editor. And we've been talking about the top stories of the year. And it seems like, as you put it, Jennifer, early on, that there are buckets of stories. And, of course, there's this big mega COVID bucket that we've been talking about. But within this bucket of top stories of the year, do we have another important category we need to look at?
Yeah, I think it's been really hard to pick, but we can't ignore the cruise season, I think, especially because our newsroom has been really focused on covering the cruise industry in Juneau from the perspective of the residents of Juneau. And I don't know, it's almost easy to forget that it happened, but it happened. So, which was really crazy because back in like April, when the cruise ships are normally starting to show up in Juneau, we had two very large hurdles to the cruise season starting up that seemed insurmountable. One was that the Canadian border was closed. And so there was just no way for cruise ships to to come to Juneau because they all have to stop in Canada, and they couldn't do that. So that seemed impossible. And the other one was that the CDC had put out this conditional sailing order, which basically said that the cruise ships and the ports that they visited had to jump through a bunch of hoops. And those hoops were actually not very well defined in many cases. So it was, even for the cruise ships, the cruise companies and the ports that sort of wanted to participate in the program the way the CDC wanted them to, there wasn't a lot of information about what exactly we were supposed to do to sort of get ready for the cruise season. Both of those sort of fell like dominoes, like right in time. And by July, which was, you know, halfway through our season normally, the first cruise ship showed up. And for the most part, you know, it was, from what we know, safe-ish. You know, I think it was the second cruise ship that came to Juneau. There, somebody tested positive. And one of the deals that Juneau had was like that we weren't going to treat any COVID patients that came off of a cruise ship here. So somebody got medevaced out of Juneau. But then there just wasn't a lot of spread going on. People were vaccinated. The cruise ships were highly vaccinated, the people who came on them. So in some ways, it was a success. But when it was all said and done and we counted up how many people actually came, it was 125,000 passengers, which is a lot for a town of 30,000. But that is less than 10% of the number of people who came in 2019, which was our last normal season. And that also means that we made less than 10% of the revenue that the city normally makes from cruise ship passengers, which is a lot of money. We charge people a per-person tax who come on a cruise ship, and that's a big part of the city's bottom line.
So there's some interesting things to learn from this, I'm sure.
Yeah, and the city's getting ready for next year. At this point, they think it's going to be big. They think everybody's coming back. And the cruise ships and the city are sort of getting ready for that. I'm not going to make any predictions about what next year's cruise season will look like. But
Iron Man's supposed to come next
year. Oh,
yeah.
And then Iron Man, which is going to bring, I don't remember how many thousands of people next year, too.
The athletes, their support crews, family. It'll be quite a a crowded town for a few days.
It'll be quite a something. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break right now. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the important work, groundbreaking work that the newsroom did covering avalanches and kind of investigating the whole problem of dealing with them. So we'll come back. I'm with Jennifer Pemberton and Rasha McChesney from KTOO News.
Hi, I'm Mikeline Dukla from NPR's Global Health Desk. There's a word for what you feel when you encounter something vast and unexplainable. Ah, it's a crucial part of experiencing happiness. It also fuels the reporting you hear on this station every day. We find the awe-inspiring in the world and share it right here so you can experience it too. Give to the station that inspires you. Here's how.
Donate at ktoo.org.
Afternoon programming is made possible by Royal Caribbean Group, the parent company of Celebrity Cruises, Royal Caribbean International, and Silver Sea. Together with Alaskan cruise destinations, forging long-term partnerships to support community needs. More at royalcaribbeangroup.com.
So we're looking at 2021 in the rearview mirror, and I have Jennifer Pemberton, the managing editor of KTOO News, with me, and Rasha McChesney, a daily news editor, and they have their eyeballs all over all kinds of stories. But they did find time this year to do a newsroom-wide effort on studying avalanches, looking at the research, looking at the threats, looking at the potential threats in the future. And so, Jennifer, you want to talk about what led to this project?
Yeah, so in February, the Barents neighborhood, which is just a couple blocks of houses above Juneau Douglas High School, very close to downtown, was evacuated due to unprecedented avalanche danger. The city's emergency manager, Tom Matisse, went door to door in that neighborhood. He said he knocked on 39 doors that night because he had just forecasted an extreme avalanche danger, which was like, on a scale of, you know, 1 to 5 was a 6, you know, or I can't remember exactly what the scale was, but it was off the charts. He had never forecasted that kind of instability before and wanted to get people out of the neighborhood. the city set up an evacuation shelter at Centennial Hall with these tents. And again, we were talking about, you know, things that are different during COVID. This was February, so we weren't even very vaccinated as a community, trying to keep people separated. Luckily, like, only one family ended up using the shelter, because out of 39 doors that he knocked on, you know, some people weren't there. A lot of people stayed with friends and family. One couple took their RV and drove it to a safer part of town for the night. Things sort of stabilized overnight. There was no avalanche. But that experience and reporting on that, I've since moved into the neighborhood. So it's gotten way more
prompted
personal.
You to buy a house.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. But before that even happened, I was just really interested by that experience of, like, this seemed like a very unique thing. And it turns out that, like, people do not live in avalanche paths in other places. And really interestingly, last year, or 2020, was one of the most dangerous avalanche years in the country, not because of climate reasons, but because people were on lockdown and ski resorts were closed and people were backcountry skiing. And most people who die in avalanches die when they're in the backcountry and they're skiing sort of off-piste. People don't die in their homes in avalanches, and that turns out it's not a risk pretty much anywhere else in the world except Juneau, Alaska.
Urban avalanche capital.
The urban avalanche capital, which is what we called it, because there's no such thing as urban avalanches. In fact, when Russia Googled it, what did you find was an urban avalanche?
It's like snow falling off of people's roofs.
Right.
It was like people are dying in urban avalanches of you know, snow falling off of buildings, not because your house is beneath the base of a mountain.
Right. So I've thought, boy, this is something special about Juneau. And so we looked into it and we did a 4-part series and a really sort of terrifying and compelling video from our video department. All of that is at ktoo.org/avalanche. You should check it out if you didn't see it. We learned a lot. But I think, you know, going back to impact being the most important part for me, you know, there was the history and we learned a lot about sort of where the city has been in avalanches that have happened. We, through some tree ring research that we learned about, scientists are able to go back a couple hundred years. But I think where the series really hit home was Claire Strempel, one of our reporters, went and talked to people who live in these houses right now, the houses that were evacuated, to really get a sense of how they calculate that risk and how they understand that risk and maybe how that's different from how experts and the city calculate that risk. And I want to listen to that story because I think it's really the heart of why we did the series.
Janice and Butch Holst have owned the yellow house in the middle of their block since the late 1970s.
We're a landmark, yeah. The whole San Behrens Avenue.
Janice sits in an armchair in her cozy, slightly nautical-themed living room. She and her husband have been married nearly 60 years.
60.
At the time of the purchase, they didn't know the house where they planned to raise their children was in a zone that National Geographic magazine once called the nation's worst risk for a major avalanche disaster. Janice's husband found out about the risk at work from a colleague.
He was bragging about having found a nice house right here with the schools and having 4 kids. It was perfect. And the friend said, really? I don't know why. It's a big avalanche area. You're not going to be safe there. And and we've lived here happily ever since, but we have had some scary times.
Behind their house, the 3,000-foot avalanche chute is bright green with new spring foliage that stands out from the darker, older forest on either side. When avalanche danger climbed into the extreme range in their neighborhood this last winter, the Holsts went and stayed with their grown son for a night. But Janice doesn't have any plans to leave her home for much longer than that. The city has toyed with the idea of a home buyout program, but she says there's almost no way they'd take it. And waxed the arm of her chair for emphasis.
I don't think so, unless it was like a million, trillion, zillion, billion dollars and a free maid and cooked meals every day and a mink coat to keep me warm.
She says they have great neighbors, and the avalanches everyone's talking about haven't hurt them. Lisa Abias lives down the street from the Holsts. She and her husband didn't know they were buying into the avalanche zone either.
Did the realtor say anything?
Oh, no. Mm-mm.
Lender?
Nope. Nobody said a word. You know, and that was back in 1969.
She raised six kids in the house and says when there was avalanche risk, they slept against the uphill side wall downstairs. She says she'd take a home buyout if it was offered.
But if the city wants to buy the house, come on, bring it on.
In 2011, the city of Juneau contracted Swiss researchers to assess the risk to the Barrens neighborhood. The report said a major avalanche could run all the way from the top of Mount Juneau to the Gastineau Channel, with enough force to destroy wood frame houses in its path.
When you look at town and you see these huge snowfields looming over neighborhoods, I mean, the gentleman that I brought in from Switzerland and France and other places in Europe look at me and say, "We can't believe you built here."
Tom Matisse runs the city's avalanche program. He co-authored a study that describes the risk to 60 homes, a hotel, and a boat harbor in the Barrens avalanche path. City code reveals how seriously the municipality takes avalanche risk. In severe avalanche zones, like the Barrens path, the city of Juneau doesn't allow new construction. No additions, no in-law units, no new bedrooms. Nothing that would increase the human density of the area. But he says right after he took on his job, he floated the idea of home buyouts. He says the assembly at the time balked at the cost share the city would have to take on and decided not to spend the money. Matisse says it's a hard sell because people who have moved in more recently knew about the risk when they bought. Sellers now have to disclose it. Matisse says one way to get the city and residents to consider a buyout might be after an avalanche causes damage in the neighborhood.
Because as soon as you get the insurance company involved because you damaged your house, that actually could be used as the cost share. So we could get some FEMA money to come in and buy that property, use that insurance money instead of government money to be that local cost share, make that homeowner whole, move them out of that resident, and turn that into open park space for perpetuity.
Some people on Barrens think the studies overestimate the risk. One accused Matisse of fear-mongering. Sherry Brackup-Binder is a community psychologist and an independent researcher based on the East Coast.
I'm a disaster researcher. I think about disasters all the time. But for residents, disasters are just one point among many that make up, you know, the complex reality of their lives.
She studied home buyouts in the wake of major storms like Hurricane Sandy. And she found that while municipalities see buyouts as a tool for prevention, people see them as a tool for recovery. That is, most homeowners don't want to leave a perfectly good home in a dangerous place, but they are more likely to consider leaving a damaged home.
So I can look at pictures of a community that's in the path of an avalanche and think, yep, those houses shouldn't be there, right? That's not a great place to build a community. But it's not my house, right? It's not my community that we're talking about dissolving, and it's not my life that we're talking about upending.
She says there are social consequences to a move, like the Hulse who love their neighbors, and the financial. There's no guarantee about getting the market value for a home. And Juneau's housing market is tight. If more than 30 households wanted to move at once, that would be tough. Current city policy offers residents an avalanche warning system. Someone to literally knock on their doors and ask them to get out of harm's way. But while the city won't add people to the area, it hasn't invested in a plan to reduce the number of people who live there yet. Their only path out of harm's way is to sell their homes and pass the risk to someone else. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strimple for KTOO.
In case you've just joined us, we are looking at 2021 in the rearview mirror, and the KTOO News Department did a lot of coverage of the threat of avalanches in the Juneau area. I'm with Jennifer Pemberton, managing editor for KTOO News, and Rasha McChesney, a daily news editor. Well, we've talked about a lot of heavy, serious subjects, from COVID to missing people to the struggling cruise ship industry, but we wanted to leave people with some of the good things that happened in 2021. I asked you to pick some of your favorite stories, so we have two favorite stories to share.
Yeah, I started looking back at all the stories that I actually enjoyed from the year, and it turns out that there were a lot of good news stories. And that is something that we are always on the lookout for here at KTOO. It's one of our priority areas. It's just like joy, bring people joy, like focus on the good things that are happening in the community. And it was a really great year for a lot of things like this. The one that I want to listen to is one of Rasha's stories, and it's from last winter. And this is technically a COVID story. When live music wasn't possible, this really amazing thing happened in downtown called Choir From Cars. And Rasha went and checked it out and just made a really beautiful story that makes me smile. So let's play that one.
All righty.
Is there life on Mars?
I don't know what I was expecting when I showed up to Bruce Simonson's Choir From Cars, but hearing dozens of singers launch into a choral rendition of a David Bowie song was not it. Bobby Mitchell and her friend Susan Loomis, though, are into it.
It's so much fun, and it's really bizarre. Yeah.
The two pulled up and parked right in front of the doors of the church. They've both been coming for a few weeks, and when I ask Mitchell why, she's incredulous.
Because it's the choir. So miss it.
We desperately love singing. We miss being able to sing in the choir. There's nothing like the sound of voices singing together.
So on Saturday afternoons, neighbors turn on their radios, people in parked cars grab wireless mics, and everyone settles in for this apart but together choir. The guy who's responsible for piecing all of this together is Bruce Simonson. He's the classic archetype of a choir director. Wild Beethoven hair that he's constantly tucking behind his ears. He sings all the parts.
Help the ones are going to Mars. Is there life on Mars? And that's what the baritone or the bass part does as well. Everyone know where I'm at?
He's a longtime choir director in Juneau. He says this thing wasn't his idea. He saw some people doing it on the East Coast and thought it could be replicated in Juneau. And he made up the name, but people are calling it all sorts of things, like car choir or karaoke. He started gathering equipment in October and launched the whole thing in January. And there is a lot of stuff that goes into organizing it. There's a volunteer inside of the church in a tangle of cables at a mixing board. He's constantly adjusting inputs and levels and fiddling with a recorder. But from the outside, the experience is pretty simple. Everyone gets a quick crash course in the tech. Here's Tom Melville with mine.
So that's our headphones. On 107.1.
And this is how I hear everyone else singing.
That's how you hear everybody sing. And you need one of our...
I do.
Okay, you get number 9.
Simonson stands on the sidewalk with a music stand in front of him, and he leads the group.
Because I'm out here, and I'm actually singing at the top of my lungs.
It's pretty odd. You really can't hear people singing from their cars, so he's just kind of alone out there. A few weeks ago, though, he had company.
The Ravens, they were like singing along with me. They just were going for it. And I said, do you hear the Ravens? And no, they didn't, because the microphones we use are very directional. So you can't really hear what's going on outside.
There's a woman who lives close enough that she can just stop in and grab gear and sing from her living room. Another one sings from the sidewalk across the street. And I finally settled back into my car and turned on the radio. It was weird to be alone, but part of a group. It was overwhelming. Simonson says this is normal.
The first time you do it and you haven't been singing for like a year in a group, it's really emotional. It's what's interesting is that like the first 20 minutes and you get kind of verklempt, if you want to use that word. But then people kind of like forget about how weird it is, what we're really doing here. And they kind of get used to singing into the microphone because you have to do that. And if you're not used to it, that's a different thing.
But then it started to feel like a regular choir rehearsal. People are cracking jokes and laughing at each other and correcting each other's pitches. And for an hour and a half in the sun, it started to feel normal. The best part is that you can turn your radio on and everyone's voice is broadcast in and you're listening to yourself in concert. For now, Simonson says they're meeting every Saturday at 1 p.m. until we can all start meeting in person again. In Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
You know, that gives me chills a little bit.
I was going to say, we're all sitting in here smiling, listening to it for the first time in 9 months. And it's just like, ah, this is why we do what we do, people. This is why radio works.
It was a really good time for, like, that hopefulness, too. And I think also there was a period of time, because the choir is on a little bit of a hiatus now, but there was a period of time where you could drive through downtown Juneau on Saturdays and turn your radio on. And if you were on the right channel, you would just drive through a neighborhood and all of a sudden hear people practicing and then drive out of the neighborhood and it would be something completely different. But it was just this, like, I don't know, there's just this corner of town figuring out a way to make it work.
It is what I call one of those deliciously Juno stories.
Yep.
So we have one more story to share.
Yeah, and I think it was hard to choose, for me at least, the happy stories this year. We had a couple of really great food stories from Lindsay about the opening of Black Moon Coven. Who opens a restaurant in a pandemic? Lindsay answered that story and kind of got at the heart of that decision-making process. And we also had another really great story about Pelmini, which is this staple in town and where it came from, and, you know, maybe why it's more of like the fast food of Pelmini and not
the
actually,
dumpling restaurant.
Exactly. And they opened, you know, that we partnered with Alaska Public Media in Anchorage because they just opened a new Pelmini spot there. So we had like a two-person reported story. But one story that really stuck out to me, and I think it's because I had just never really thought of defining the natural world around me in this way, is a story that Jennifer did about this cloud formation here that we've all seen. You've definitely seen it. You look out at the channel, there are these snaking clouds along the mountains. And someone wrote to us, I think, and said, is that a Maloya snake? And Jennifer just sort of took us on this adventure of, what is that cloud that we all see all the time called?
All right. I love those kind of stories that you do just because somebody asked a question. Here we go.
A movie came out in 2014 called Clouds of Sils Maria. It stars Kristen Stewart and Juliette Binoche. The climax of the story features this scene in the Swiss Alps where the two women hike up high in the mountains to witness an early morning cloud formation called the Maloya Snake. It's a mist that flows like water along the valley floor.
I think it's turning into the snake.
I had never heard of the film. I love Kristen Stewart, but no, this is educational experience for me.
Wes Adkins is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Juneau. He'd never heard of the Maloya snake either, but once he saw clips from the movie, he knew exactly what it was.
I think there is not a meteorologist in town who doesn't observe this with awe every time they go hiking, every time they commute down Egan Drive, and we see it all the time here.
These clouds do form all the time here. You can see them crawling down Perseverance Trail or along Treadwell Ditch on Douglas. They're very snake-like and cling to the side of the mountains close to the ground. Sometimes a big fat snake as wide as the channel rolls into town. Atkins says that the changes in temperature, pressure, and moisture that cause the snake to form are always there, but they're not always visible. Sometimes, though, conditions are right, and you can actually see the boundary between cloud and no cloud.
What's really cool is when you start to see, and you can kind of witness some of this in the film, where these Maloya snakes start to do flips or cartwheels, and people can witness this, you know, just above them in downtown, just over Gastineau Channel.
There's not a lot of cloud watching in Juneau. We don't get white puffy clouds that appear in the shapes of animals while we lie in a field on our backs. So these moving fog banks, these snakes, are some of the most dynamic clouds we have. These are our clouds. But we don't have snakes in Alaska, so what should we call them?
I started looking through some resources, and I found this verb, which is nagaz. Clouds are moving along.
Hune Lance Twitchell is an associate professor of Alaska Native Languages at the University of Alaska Southeast. Nagats, is a Tlingit word. It also means migration.
And so gas is a house post. So this is the verb that's, there's a version of it to say, ade hausha gas, we migrated there, which would be sort of like saying, we picked up our house post and we brought it over there.
Clouds that migrate like people. That's even better than a snake. But sometimes a cloud is just a cloud.
Sometimes the Tlingit language is just so matter of fact, you know, and I think just what I've heard, it seems to be that way about clouds because we have clouds like 300 days of a year.
Right. So
it figures you'd have this whole stack of metaphors for sunlight because you're like, whoa, this thing is back, you know, and so, but with the day-to-day stuff, maybe not.
Kune says he doesn't know if this word has been used to describe these clouds before. From multiple elders, the consensus seemed to be that if there was another Tlingit word for these cloud snakes, it might have been lost with the loss of language speakers.
One of the great tragedies of colonialism, and there are many, is that nobody really took the time to figure out what the people knew about the land around them, the weather, the water.
You can see these clouds any time of year and any time of day in Juneau, but if you really want to be intentional about it, Wes Atkins at the Weather Service says dawn or dusk are good bets when the temperature is changing, or just before or after a rainy spell.
So those are some of the things that if you were a Maloya snake stalker, you might want to clue yourself in on.
The Weather Service doesn't include these cloud snakes in their forecasts because they don't really impact the weather. They don't bring rain. They aren't harbingers of storms. But Atkins says we should still be on the lookout for them.
I'm originally from Alabama. We were really flat there for the most part. There's nothing like this. So I think we can all relish this chance to see something special.
And Hune says that the Weather Service and the rest of us should start practicing how to talk about it in Tlingit.
To say the clouds are moving along, you would say, Nagats.
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 In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
And that wraps up 2021 in the rearview mirror with KTOO News managers Jennifer Pemberton and Rasha McChesney as our guides, leaving you with the wide vista ahead for 2022. In the coming days, we will be playing holiday programs in this time slot. Hope you enjoy that. But this is my last Juneau Afternoon program of 2021, brought to you by the KTOO Arts and Culture team, led by Cheryl Snyder. Shelley Delaney and I share the hosting duties. From all of us at KTOO, stay warm, stay safe. May the holidays fill you with joy and anticipation for 2022. Thanks for joining us. Until next year.
Support for Juneau Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Tlingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.